Hello and welcome to Castle Talk, where we talk to writers and creators of today's genre worlds. I'm your host, Jason Henderson, publisher at Castle Bridge Media, home of the Castle of Horror anthology series. Tonight, we're chatting with Robert Englund, who is the focus of the new documentary, Hollywood Dreams and Nightmares, the Robert Englund story on Screenbox and digital, June 6th, 2023. This is a guest who needs almost no introduction, a very, very varied and deep actor who all of his co-actors just have so much love and respect for throughout the documentary. Welcome, Mr. Englund.
Welcome to prime time.
Yeah, I want to start with something that that a lot of people said on the in the documentary. Somebody said that there's this value of an adult, and they were talking about you, this value of an adult listening to you. And I think you said something similar about another actor. And it was this ongoing conversation throughout the whole documentary about you going to younger actors and giving them pointers, younger directors, and giving them just a sense of confidence, and that people had done that for you. And I wondered if you could talk about how important that is in your life as a performer.
Well, I don't know how many of your viewers are going to recognize this name. I would hope a lot. But when I was a child, one of my first sort of adult experiences was watching late night talk shows. And the beloved Steve Allen from The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
And, you know, great jazz composer and one of the early hosts of, you know, the 11:30 Tonight Show. And he had himself surrounded by this great ensemble of comedians, and people will recognize these names: Tim Conway, who most people know from the Carol Burnett Show, Don Knotts from the Andy Griffith Show, and then a great actor, Louis Nye, Tom Poston from the Bob Newhart Show. And that was the comedy ensemble. And I love these guys. I love them. My dad loved them. We would, you know, I have these great memories of, you know, my mom and dad with their cigarettes, you know, and me. And they let me watch it. And it was so wonderful. And when I was 12 and a half going on 13, I had been farmed off as sort of to be sort of looked after by this gorgeous 14-year-old girl, a wannabe actress in a professional children's theater. And they figured if she had to worry about me, that she couldn't get in any trouble with the older boys in this in this company. And I went along, you know, because she's just, you know, great, beautiful older girl with long legs, and she wanted to be an actress, and I figured I'd be, you know, painting scenery and walking around the flashlight as an usher, you know, seating people. I wound up getting all the starring roles. I auditioned. I was Pinocchio. I was Aladdin. I was Hansel in Hansel and Gretel, Peter Pan, all this stuff, and I came off stage early on in the run of Pinocchio, and I was backstage with my false nose, and it was I'd had my curtain call, and I'd been lifted on the shoulders in the curtain call, and I was addicted to getting the laugh and all my laughs in the same place every night. I'd even added more arrows stuck into me, you know, when the Native Americans chased Pinocchio across the stage. And of course, I'm made of wood, so arrows can't hurt me. And
right.
Every performance, I'd add an extra arrow and get a bigger, cheap laugh. And I loved it. I couldn't get enough of it. And I'm standing backstage, and this big, tall man in big, giant Clark Kent glasses comes up, and he says, and he's got thick head of black hair, slick back, and this big redhead with him. And he says, where's that kid that played Pinocchio? You know, and they kind of pushed me to the front of the crowd. And I was, you know, getting ready to get my nose taken off. And he took me aside. Mm-hmm. And it was Steve Allen.
Yeah.
And he took me aside and he said, you know, kid, you're funny as hell. You can have this if you want. You can do this if you want.
Wow.
And no one, I mean, I don't, you know, I don't know that adults do that as much anymore. You know, when I was a kid, you were supposed to be an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer. You know, nobody wanted to wear black turtlenecks and be a musician or an actor. It just wasn't done. I had to literally keep my acting life separate from my baseball, surfing, swim champion life. It was kind of schizophrenic. because you would be teased if you wanted to be show business back then. But this was getting that praise from somebody I watched at night, you know, from television. And it was just a great gift of confidence. And over the years, that's happened to me several times. It's happened to me with really important directors early in my career. It happened with me in the theater early in my career, where someone that had starred in The Crucible on the West End in London took me aside and told me how, you know, that he literally said, "Robert, if you didn't have any talent, you'd still work because of your face." And I went, "What? Huh? What does that mean?" Now I kind of know what that means. Character face, etc.
It's an expressive face. I mean, you look like Danny Kaye.
Yeah, but the thing is, I've had that happen to me. I had Henry Fonda took me seriously back in the middle 70s. I shared an RV with Henry for 6 weeks. And I wouldn't play my rock and roll, and I ate his apples that he grew in.
Are you talking about during the Great Smoky Roadblock?
Yeah. And Henry, when he found out I was a stage actor, he opened up and he talked to me like we were just two guys in the makeup room, you know. Wow. He just let me in, and he told me stories about Jimmy Stewart and about Betty Davis and Betty Davis's sister and about Mr. Roberts and about the Provincetown Players and Josh Logan and rooming with James Stewart and just opened his heart to me, you know. And I've had that happen over the years. John Saxon did that for me. And even on a movie like Urban Legend, you know, I had lunch several times with the great John Neville because I knew he'd done Othello with Richard Burton.
Oh, right.
And he told me stories about Olivier and about Alec Guinness and stuff when they were all young and working on the West End. And it's just, and then gave me that respect that I could, that I was allowed into that kind of, you know, behind, you know, backstage kind of sharing.
Wow. Well, I mean, but so many people, so first of all, I have a thought about that. You said, you know, there's this reticence people have for praising kids. And you say in the documentary, you go, you know, there's so much value in praise. And you hear people knee-jerking all the time where they'll go, you know, you shouldn't tell kids that they're good at, like there's this notion
everybody's afraid the parents will sue them now, you know?
That's possible, but I hear people say that they're afraid they're going to break the kid by being too nice to them. I hear this.
But it's got to be the real thing. It shouldn't be giving somebody a gold star for showing up on time.
Right.
You're supposed to show up on time. You give them that gold star.
But to share when you see something.
A really good Romeo and Juliet reading in the ninth grade, you know?
Yeah.
That's when you tell them, boy, you know, you can read iambic pentameter. That's a real gift. You have a real instinct. If you're considering this, you have a gift, you know? Yeah. And I think that's important. I think you do got to share it because you need those sort of bridge supports of confidence as you mature. And you know, actors, we're very fragile. We need that reinforcement. And people always use the word ego. It's not so much ego. It's that we just don't know. We can't really see it, you know? I mean, you can go to Video Assist and see it, but even that's not the same, you know?
No, absolutely.
You really do need your director's reinforcement. And some directors really are really good about that. They leave you alone. They know when to leave you alone. They see when you're floundering, you know? Sometimes it's just a word, you know, or a try this, or a smoke a cigarette.
Yeah.
Or why don't you have a drink in this scene or something like that? They just know you need to anchor yourself, you know, and those are the directors I love working with.
It's so interesting to think that as you move through your career, we imagine you become a veteran and you don't need that stuff anymore. But we're still human. Right. And you still need direction. You still need directors. It's interesting for me to hear you say that that's still something that's important to you.
Well, in the theater, in the run of a play, you get it right. You know, you get it right. Sometimes you can get it perfect a couple of times, or you can at least get one act perfect or a sequence perfect that you've longed to do. And that's very fulfilling. But then there's that strange ephemeral thing that happens in the theater where the night you're letter perfect, the audience is ho-hum. And then there can be another night where you're hung over and you're conscious of mistakes that are being made around you, and the audience goes nuts. They love it. And people come back to the dressing room and say they've never seen anything so great. And you've actually forgotten half of your big speech or something. And so, you know, that truth as well.
Yeah.
But as a film actor, every time I do a movie, every time I do a television show, I'm learning something new, and you know, it's for posterity, and I always want to change it, and I always want to fix it, which is why when you hear actors say they can't watch themselves, that's why. Because we always see a better way to do it, or something else we wish we would have done. Driving home from a set, actors are the worst drivers in the world, because oh God, I delivered that line wrong, or this is the word I should have stressed, that's what that scene was about.
Yeah,
you know, and we beat ourselves up about that stuff.
I know I have to wrap up, but I have one more question, which is we hear from your wife many times in the documentary, and it's noted that you've been married for I think now 35 years.
35 years. Oh my God.
And it's just wonderful. And like Amanda Weiss and others just speak glowingly of the both of you. So I think for listeners, like I don't even know how to phrase this. What's the deal there? Like what is the secret to a 35 year marriage?
Stockholm syndrome.
Well, I think part of it is, I think a lot of it is that, I knew when I met Nancy, I'd had one marriage. I'd been divorced. Mm-hmm. I married too young, and I'd had an unsuccessful relationship that I wanted to work. And then I had another relationship in which I was betrayed, and I was old enough to understand that some of my heart, some of my capacity for love had been eaten away by those experiences and those disappointments.
Yeah.
And when I met Nance, I knew him almost immediately. I used to make her drive scouting locations to places I'd already selected.
Yeah, just this to is be touched in the car on the documentary, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Just to be in the car with, how cruel am I? You know, but
that sounds utterly charming.
But the thing is, I knew this was it. I knew if I was in love for the last time, and I knew what I would become if she wouldn't have me. I knew I was just going to become one of those a-holes, the misogynist, men, yeah, picking up women in bars all the time with some terrible line. Hey, what's your sign, baby? You know,
it gets tiresome after a while.
That.
Sure.
I thought, oh God, I can't be that guy. And she, I cleaned up my baggage, and she ordered me to clean up my baggage, and I courted her. And the other thing is that there people used to marry. There was a little bit of an age difference. Mm-hmm. I think after World War II, people got married. They were the same age a lot, mm-hmm. High school sweethearts and all of that. But before that, in society, men were a little older, a little more established, maybe 5 years older, maybe 10 years older even.
Right.
But they could pay the bills. They paid off their debts. They had a good job or a decent job or a real right. job. And people would get married. And so that stress, that financial stress, wasn't as much a part of marriage in those days. And I think the fact that I'm older than Nancy actually helped, because we were able to enjoy perks and the benefits and the travel that my career presented us, we didn't have kids because I was so busy internationally for 10 years, but that's what I had worked for.
Yeah.
I didn't know it at the time, but that's really what I had worked for all my life, because they don't tell you that when you're in acting school, that it's really fun to do a movie in Rome, and it's really funny to do a movie in London, and it's really fun to do a movie in Romania and Africa and Israel and yeah. St. Petersburg. And it's this great adventure that comes down the pike for you. And I not only had that adventure, but I had it with my wife. She was there for all of that. So we have that great shared history. And I think that's probably really conducive to our longevity.
That's really wonderful. I'm so glad that you shared that, because I think I think it'll strike people as being a really great story.
The thing I can tell young people is the thing about love and the thing why what that's great about it is you share a history with someone, and there no one else gets to witness the same things except you two. Mm. There comes a point where you two have witnessed more together than anyone else, and yeah. you have that, you have that, and you need that, and you can bounce that off each other.
That's wonderful. I have to wrap because I know you need to get to your next conversation.
All right.
Although I do want to see a romantic comedy about your life with Nancy. I think you should write that. Yes. I think you should write that. I think, you know,
right.
Spend the writer's strike period.
I'll be pushing her in the canal in Venice.
Oh my God. Look, you could write that. You could spend the next 6 weeks writing that. That's a great idea. All right. Have a fantastic afternoon. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Definitely people should check out the documentary. Bye.
Bye-bye.